Did you come across Italian? Captain Wright, Reel 5. You were describing the anti-handling devices on the German mines.
Yes, now the anti-handling devices were methods of arming the odd one so that if the mine clearing agency had had neutralized the primer by pushing the pin in and then pulling the mine up as apparently disarmed, they would pull a wire or something attached to a peg down below, which would set the whole thing off, which was singularly nasty. But so what we had to do was to disarm the thing by pushing the pin in, dig all the way around with one's hands, feel at the side to see if there's an anti-handling device connected at the side, feel underneath to see if there was underneath. And so it took a bit of time and care.
Roughly how long would it take you then if you were doing it carefully to actually lift
I
a
suppose with
mine?
practice, about 3 minutes. Which, I mean, if you add all that up, it comes to quite a long time.
Did you come across Italian mines at all?
Oh, they were terribly primitive, yes. They were ridiculous things. They had tripwires, and I think they weren't even wires, they were strings, and so they would deteriorate in the weather, and they'd be sort of flapping about, and no, they weren't very clever. I don't know what damage they do. I don't think we ever had anybody go over one of them.
And laying our own mines, how long would it take roughly for a chap to lay a mine and
Oh, well, those
cover it
EP
over?
Mark IIs, I mean, it'd take, you just, they did it with their bayonets usually, I suppose. Dig a hole which is about 4 inches deep, I suppose. No, a bit more than that, because it had to be covered. About 6 inches, I suppose, yes. Shove the thing in, arm it, drop it in, cover it, finish, about a minute.
And I mean, presumably you'd be doing this in teams. Were there drills for laying minefield and
Oh,
for
indeed,
clearing out?
yes. I rather forget now. Well, it was just a question of laying out these signal wires. You see, once the signal wire was in place, all that chap had to do was just walk down it and put a mine in every time he came to a knot.
Not.
So it was very simple.
Were they all on the same pattern, or did you sometimes vary the pattern of the layout of a minefield?
Well, I think what you could do is to, instead of putting A, B, C, D in that order, you could put D, F, B, A, or whatever, and so in that respect they were different. But the signal cables and the knots, they were all exactly the same. Or the sets of them were.
How far behind the actual front line were you when you were on the Roe Isaac Ridge? Do you know how far forward the infantry
Oh, I'm about having a bet
positions
on that,
were?
darling. About a mile? No, not as much, about half a mile. Half a mile back, I think, yes.
Were there any other tasks that were of importance?
Yes, well, the Air Force, the Luftwaffe used to drop bombs, and a lot of them had delayed action fuses or anti-handling fuses or whatever. And all communication in those days was done by line telephone, and so the telephone would go, and there'd be a very nice colonel at the other end saying, "Oh, is that two field company? Could you come and have a look? We've just been bombed." And so I'd go out and have a look at these things, and I couldn't. I mean, I couldn't steam them and get the explosive. I didn't have the equipment or anything like that. So I looked to see what sort of fuse it was, because it was so rocky that the bomb was always on the top, usually. I'd see what sort of fuse it was, and if it was an anti-handling one, I'd keep well away from it. If it was a delayed action one, everybody was dug in anyway. All I got to do is put a slab of gun cotton on and blow it up, having jumped into a hole in the meantime. So bomb disposal wasn't awfully sophisticated.
Wasn't a matter of trying to defuse them then.
No, no. And even more ridiculous, when I come to think of it, I was armed with a 4.5 Webley, which is a dreadful weapon, terribly heavy, and it had lead bullets, which wouldn't have endeared me to the Germans if they'd captured me. I used to go armed with this, as I always was, and very often the Germans had dropped a thing called a Molotov bread basket or something, and it was a sheet metal thing which disintegrated as soon as it was thrown out of the aircraft, and then in it were these butterfly bombs, which again had a sort of sheet metal casing in two bits, and they flew out, and as a bomb came down, this sort of wing thing above would rotate, and as it did so, it would arm the bomb. The bomb was a cylinder about 5 inches long and about 3 inches diameter, I suppose, full of TNT, and it was anti-personnel.
Sounds like a primitive version of the cluster bomb.
Yes, except the cluster bomb would go down armed and not be exploded until you stepped on it or something, which is very much worse. This thing would usually explode on impact, I think. I don't know. But anyway, I see these things scattered around, and the simplest thing to do was to put a explosive charge on them and a safety fuse and light the thing and shove off and blow them up. I thought it was a bit expensive, so I used to, there was always a hole in the ground somewhere quite close, and I'd climb into one of these, line the sights of my 4.5 up against it, hold it as firm as I could, put my head down, pull the trigger, and I'd never hit one in about 6 months, I think. It was a futile exercise.
Because the 4.5 was so inaccurate, presumably.
Well, and the chap wielding it was.
You mentioned also that you were doing defence works. Were you digging or fortifying positions on the Rysat Ridge?
Yes, I slipped up on that one a bit. I was putting in an advanced headquarters or something, and we would drill these with a compressor, and then push a charge down and blow it up, and cut the rock away. And then we'd cover it over with timber, which was brought up, corrugated iron, and then cover it over with the debris that we'd dug out.
Was this divisional headquarters or brigade headquarters?
Well, it could be anything, really. I did a divisional headquarters. I did a gunner regiment headquarters. I can't think how many I did. But they were all the same, just a sort of the thing about 10 foot by 4 foot, and about.
How deep down would you go when you were blasting out a shelter like that?
Oh, about 5 feet. 5 feet, I should say. But all the kit that went into the roofing of it, timber had to be brought up. You see, and I remember, I think it was Colonel Blundell coming up and saying, I was being too extravagant with the timber, you see. And so I thought, well, that's a bit funny. I would have thought that this was a minimum amount. But anyway, I reduced them a bit and filled the thing over. And about a week later or less, I suppose, as these people moved in, the thing collapsed, you see. And this furious colonel, Colonel Bastin, I remember, he was a middleweight boxing champion of the army or something, great bloke. He was furious, and so I didn't listen to Colonel Blundell any longer. I should have said, oh, yes, I'll put the less in, and I'd taken their notice. Mm. But,
were you under close supervision, or were you usually told what to do and left to get on with it?
No, fortunately for me, because as I'll probably explain later, I wasn't on very good terms with my... he was then second in command and later became company commander. Nothing I could ever do was right, and so I avoided him as far as I could, which was a good thing. No, I was left very much on my own.
Well, why didn't you get on with this chap? What was the
Well, this
reason?
Happened fairly early on in my time with the company. I'd only been there about a week, I suppose. And the OC, who was a chap called Selkirk, a nice fellow, but fairly ineffective, he wanted a Jeep, because Jeeps were all the rage then, you see. And I was wondering about, because I'd been working all night somewhere, and it was about midday or something, and I was wandering around in that company area, and a Jeep suddenly appeared, you see, with a lot of people sitting and waving. And I thought, oh, it's Andrew come back from a successful hunt, you see, and it wasn't, it was a brigadier. And he was in an awful state. He'd been in a Jeep and run over an anti-tank mine, you see, which had blown the Jeep up and him. And he'd shoved off, and the Jeep was still where it had been blown up with his map in it. Well, his map was a thing about 2.5 feet square of plywood with the maps on it, a talc cover, China graph pencil marking on it, all the units of the 8th Army, which wasn't frankly good security, you see, so he was fairly exercised. And I was told I had to go and get it. So dutifully I waited until high authority came back before shoving off, and this second command appeared. And I was sent off to look for it. I was given a map reference from the brigadier. And I went to this place and came back at about, I had a walk, about 5 to 6 in the evening. And I was told I couldn't find it. And I was dismissed as being bloody stupid and told to go to brigade headquarters with a truck with a subsection in it, about 11 men. And with the idea, I suppose, of cutting a, taking the mines up and all the rest of it, which was totally unnecessary. So I go to brigade headquarters, where I'd pick up a guide. So I went to brigade headquarters, by which time it was getting dark, and eventually a guide appeared, and he was a soldier, not an officer, and... he said he knew where the thing was. I don't know, he'd been in the Jeep, I suppose. So we set off in the dark, and I was so demoralised then that I thought, well, I'd better let him drive if he knows the way. So there we were, 11 of my blokes in the back. I was sitting in the front with this chap driving, you see. And we set off north of the ridge, and we'd only been going for about 10 minutes. There was a hideous explosion. And this wonderful guide had driven into a minefield. And it hit, it was a Chev truck with single wheels on the front and double wheels on the back. And one of these double wheels had hit this mine and blown it up. And I had three chaps badly hurt in the back. And I was stunned and blinded, and we tumbled out of this thing, and this other chap disappeared, I think. Well, I had to...
But your guy just disappeared, did he?
As far as I can remember, yes.
Yeah.
And so I had to go to the nearest field ambulance on my flat feet, get them to come and rescue this bloke, these three, and then trudge all the way back with the survivors to my company location to report What had happened, you see? I got there about 2 o'clock in the morning, I think, feeling pretty upset. And my men went back to their lines, and I went to see the company, whatever it was, a sentry fellow. And he said, oh, the 2IC sir wants to see when you get back. So he had to be working. He came out, and I told him the story. He said, well, bloody well, get out there and find it. See, so I thought, oh, thanks very much. So off I went at about 2:30, I suppose. And it was about 3 miles, four maybe. And I knew my geography very well. You'll see on that map there are all sorts of references to various observation towers and things, and the bearing on them. So I went to this place, and there wasn't a sign of it at all. I got there, well, it had to be sometime in the night, because otherwise I couldn't have seen where I was. But I checked I was on the right position, couldn't see it anywhere, so I started ever-increasing circles around it, you see. Eventually I came across this jeep, which had been blown, half the length of this room, I think, away from the crater where the mine had been. And there was a map, and there was the brigadier's cap. I didn't have to clear the mines. I could see where the mines were, and I walked in between them, picked up the map case, which I stuck under my... Well, I just had to hold it with both hands. And for the cap, I took my 4.5 cap off, stuck it under my shoulder strap, and put the brigadier's hat on my bare head, you see, and trudged off due south, feeling pretty sick about things. And about an hour later, I saw an approaching jeep, and who should it be but my friend, the 2IC. And the first thing he said to me, where the hell have you been, and what are you doing there? Come off, take it off. And oh, it was bloody awful. So I pointed out to him what the map reference of this place was. We went back to have a look at it. And I said, look, it's 1 mile out of where it should have been. He wasn't mollified by that at all. We went back, and fortunately my colonel, dear old Uncle Arthur, he got wind of this and managed to, as a lieutenant colonel, go to the brigadier and complain. A, that I'd been sent out for the... Well, A, in a way, that it was his fault. B, that I had been given a no-good guide. And C, the map reference was 1 mile out. And he got some semblance of apology, but ever after that, I think it had been the same even if that happened. Nothing I could do was ever right with that chap. And he became company commander later on. I had 22 months of him, so... That's affected my account of what happened very much, because fortunately for me, I don't know if he was trying to get rid of me, but every time there was some operation coming off, I was always under command of the Point Battalion, which meant I had to patrol, which I never liked doing. I had to do some fairly hairy stuff, but I survived. But the nice thing was that I was with other regiments, and it was so much nicer.
You're beyond his reach.
Not just that, but I was with... I got on well with the infantry. I liked them very much. I never had an unpleasant experience with them. Well, I mean, as a personal relationship. So that was a sort of beginning of a weird relationship with my second in command, and the result was that I spent most of my time away, which couldn't have been better.
What kind of chap was he? Was he a regular
he was a
wartime sapper or a TA sapper?
No, he was a wartime sapper from India, funny kind of. But it hasn't made me bitter at all, but it's just influenced my experience. I don't think I was difficult, because I got on fine with the various battalions.
So that's quite an adventure going out and retrieving the marked map. How long were you at the Royal Isaac Ridge? Were you there for a
May I just
time?
Interpose something I forgot about?
Yes.
This chap, although he disliked me very much, obviously, I don't know why, he did have a sardonic sense of humour, because when he returned the map, he got a China graph pencil and wrote at the bottom, "Noted with interest, E. Rommel." So he did have a sense of humour.
Is it known if the Brigadier laughed upon receiving his...
I shouldn't think he did. He was a rather ineffective fellow. We didn't have him for very long. No, we had a marvellous Brigadier after him. Got killed. A nice chap. Sorry.
And another thing you mentioned is that you had to do surveying. Was that also at Roux Isaac, or did that come later?
Yes, well, you had to, whenever you put a minefield in, you had to surround it with wire on pickets to keep vehicles off, your own vehicles, you see. And whenever you put I didn't think a position we had to survey in, but all the minefields were surveyed in, and we used prismatic compasses.
Now you mentioned the maps. What were the maps like? Were they accurate with regard to the terrain?
Well, that's a fair example of them, the one I've got here, I think.
But I mean, did what was on the map correspond with what was on the ground?
Oh, very much so. Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Well, you could find your way around beautifully. I can remember relating to that map. As I said before, I was brought up refractory reverential to my elders and betters, and I can remember there's a road that goes over the ridge somewhere, and I and another subaltern called Jim Ivory, yes, we were just the west of that track working, and a staff car drew up just behind us, and a red-banded cap came out of the window and said, I say, come here, you see, so I rushed over, and dear old Jim, who was much more sober than I, sort of waltzed over very slowly, you see, we're looking for 161 Brigade, can you tell me where it is? And I said, oh, yes, sir, you've got to go back west until you get to the hat track or whatever it is. Go over the ridge and go over as quickly as you can. And when you get to the other side, you turn west again. Oh, well, you mean it's straight across over here? And I said, yes, sir. He says, well, now, what happens if I go straight and go round and back again? By which time Jim Ivory had appeared, you see. And he said, well, if you're lucky, you might just hear a sort of crunch of barbed wire under your wheels, but if you're unlucky, he said, your wheel would be blown off by a mine. And he said, if you still manage to go on, you'll see a lot of chaps walking around with funny-shaped tin hats on. I was sort of thinking how terrible all this was. They looked a bit miffed, but they turned round and went the way we told them.
So they went in the right direction in the end.
Yes, yes.
What was your accommodation like when you were on the Royal Isaac? Were you just living in a hole in the ground?
Hole in the ground, yes. Yes, the irony of that was that if we had to do anything at night, as I frequently had to do, I'd get back at about 4 in the morning, wearing a great coat and a battle dress and all the rest of it, you see, and I could see where the mess truck was, because it was half... It was dug in so that the engine was below the ground and couldn't be hit by low-flying aircraft. But the rear of the vehicle was sort of high and dry at the back. And I could see that against the skyline. And I'd go there, I'd probably have a warm tin of beer, and then I'd go off on a compass bearing, so many paces, until I fell into my hole. And it would have a bivouac canvas over the top of it. And then I'd fall on my bed and just go to sleep. After about 5 minutes, I'd turn over and kick my ankle with one of my boots, and so I'd take my boot off, and by then I hadn't got the energy to stay awake any longer. I'd fall asleep, kick the other ankle, wake up, take the boot off, and by about six, I was at last in my pyjamas, I think, by which time the sun was up and it was starting to get hot, so it was tough business.
What sort of things were you doing at night?
Well, we had to look at our own mines in the forward minefield. I did a patrol, I forget what it was for now, but I can't think that I could have done anything. I might have gone out with the infantry or something, I rather forget, but we did that sort of thing. But it was mainly round about the front while we were doing something or other. I think we didn't have booby traps then, or we didn't have anti-personnel mines.
Did you have complex wire entanglements to look after? Or
no, the infantry looked after that.
They did.
Mm.
So your main role really was the minefields?
Almost entirely, yes. Mm.
You were saying that you got shelled by a really large calibre Italian gun. And did you get shelled frequently? Was this a normal thing?
No, there wasn't much point really, because we were fairly well camouflaged and dug in. I tell you, when I did get shelled once, and it just shows how ineffective it was in the desert, I went to brigade headquarters for something, and just as I was leaving, the 105 started up, and I remember rushing off in my Fordson truck, and I was bracketed. I had two ahead of me and two behind me, but it didn't do anything.
How close were they, would you say?
Oh, I suppose, sort of 80 foot square? I think that's, oh, I mean 80, yes, about 80 foot square, yes.
So quite close.
Oh, quite close, yeah, mm-hmm. Left, right, in front and behind. Oh. So I wasn't impressed. When, I was talking about Colonel Blondell, when he came on the scene, I can remember attending something that I referred to before, really. The gunners decided they were going to show how they could breached the German wire, and the 25 pounders turned up for this exercise using chain shot, which is solid shot, two solid shots with a chain in between, and this thing went sort of boomeranging over our heads into the triple gunnet wire, and they did this for about half an hour, I think, and absolutely nothing happened. And John Blundell, who was always willing to try something weird, decided, well, it wasn't weird really, we had a Bren gun carrier, and we had some Bangalore torpedoes, and he turned round to the divisional commander. He didn't like sappers, I think, he was a rather taciturn fellow, and he's all right, John, go on, have a go, and off we went, straight, well, not straight at the wire, we wiggled a bit, and then turned parallel with it, threw this Bangalore torpedo under the thing, and off we shoved, and there was a loud crack, and there was a great big hole in the wire. So, hence my feeling that I don't think guns are awfully good against that.
You mentioned also being another. Oh, I think that tape's run out.
Oh dear. Do you want the light on?